the belief about mental health. The racist belief in the South was that black people didn't actually suffer from mental illness.
Hello, welcome to Into the Fold, the Hawk Foundation podcast. I'm Ike Evans of the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health. Hawk Foundation is a mental health grant-making foundation and part of the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more about the history of the Hawk Foundation, as well as our numerous grant programs, visit www.hawg.utexas.edu. We are here today with Dr. Patricia Galloway. She's a professor of archival enterprise and digital assets management at the University of Texas at Austin School of Information. Here with us to talk about her involvement with a pretty incredible project, the digitization of the archive of patient records at Central State Hospital in Virginia. From the days that it was known as the Central Lunatic Asylum for Colored Insane. And based on my very cursory knowledge, it has a little bit of something for everybody. If you're interested in digital archives, history, mental health, but also records from a time and place that implicate the history of race in this country. And so we're very glad that Dr. Galloway was able to find the time to talk to us. So it's really nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
So we could start with you giving us just a general overview of the project, what it entails, its significance, and how it is that that you came to be involved with it.
Well, we actually started the project back in about 2010 when King Davis came to us with, he in fact first contacted David Gracie, who is my retired colleague and the leader of the archives program here. And David was getting ready to retire, so he said, "Well, you need to take this over." And I was very excited about it. And he sort of said, "Well, you know, we have these. Here are these records, and they might be destroyed, and so we need to figure out what we can do. And at the very least, we should probably have them digitized." So we were working on a project to make that happen. And did so successfully. The records that we've been working on and will be working on were digitized during that period of time, during in the 2010 to 2012, 2013, it was wonderfully well done. It was done by the company that does work for the Library of Congress. It was, you know, it was really well done. And we, at that time, of course, when you've digitized something, you've got an enormous mass of digital records to manage. And so it was logical for me to be involved in this. And from that early time, I also sort of co-opted a student of mine, a PhD student, Lorraine Dong, who was really interested in this kind of material. And she actually served as the project archivist because the materials had to be organized and cleaned and prepared for digitization, and she did that work in Virginia. And ultimately she has written her dissertation about this material. So that's been really great for her, particularly because what she was looking at was one of the central issues that we're trying to address with the current project, which is how do you actually protect the security of the records as well as the privacy of the records, while at the same time making it possible for historians to make use of the records, while at the same time making it possible for descendants of the people who are portrayed in the records may be able to get access to those records. And we're having to also be very much concerned with obeying the law, namely the HIPAA requirements. That particular aspect of it has turned out to be one that's very interesting, because when we first started, their requirement was that these would never be made public to anyone.
Right.
whereas they had just not thought about historical records. And they said, oh, sorry. And so in 2013, they decided that they could be made available after 50 years or according to a time period that the individual state would approve if it were more. At least 50 years. Okay. Well, that's for most of these materials. That's the hospital started in the 1870s. For these materials, obviously most of them are available. But we really thought we should go further than that because we really thought that that there were all kinds of ways in which records like this have privacy concerns, and that we needed to actually study that. I guess it was year before last that we were involved with King Davis had the idea of assembling a group of people to discuss this, including lawyers, including people who are experts on medical records, including doctors, including people who are historians, including people who actually worked at asylums and know about these things. And so that was really a watershed for us because we actually found out what everybody thought and what everybody's requirements might be. And so now we're sort of trying to solve that issue and sort of figure out what can we do to make it possible for everyone to be satisfied and for everyone to feel that they have been right done by, and at the same time for it to be possible for people who study all of the histories that are behind all of this, not only including the history of the patients and the organization and the history of the hospital itself, but also the history of nursing and therapy for psychiatric complaints, all kinds of things like that, that are just really very, very rich. So one of the things that archivists are used to is the fact that they may hold things that nobody will be able to see while they are alive. So this is not something that bothers us, but we need to actually make sure that once you have these materials in digital form, how are you going to be able to preserve those? Because we've spent a lot of money doing it so far, and this is even before the grant that we just obtained. And so one of the things I always argue to my students is, when you do a digitization project, you need to make sure that you're going to preserve those things just as if they were original digital records because you've spent so much money putting them there. Right. And their usage is going to be maximized if you're able to continue to preserve them. So that's a kind of an introduction to some of the things that we've been thinking about and some of the things that we're hoping to tackle as a result of this grant.
Okay. And for those who don't know, Dr. King Davis is a one-time executive director at the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, where I currently work at. And it was through his involvement that I first learned of the project. And we're very much interested in being able to speak with him at some point, you know, as soon as he can find the time to visit with his old friends. So what you say that the records, that they go back as far as the hospital, mm-hmm. Goes back as far as the 1870s. Mm-hmm. Now, does that hold true for the records also?
I'm not entirely sure where they start, but they certainly start at the late 19th century. And so the records that we have worked most closely with are the records of the board meetings that were the people who ran the hospital, and then the admission records. We have not worked directly with patient records. Those had already been, I believe, microfilmed, and so they were safe. But we have worked with the admission records, which will give you sort of a little capsule summary of the patient, but not the detailed medical records, as it were, of the patient.
Okay, so, I mean, today, most people wouldn't consider a psychiatric hospital to be the sort of place that they would want to end up, much less a place calling itself the Central Lunatic Asylum for Colored Insane in Fin de Siècle, Virginia. So is it possible for, you know, for somebody to, you know, to construct a picture of what day-to-day life might have been like for a patient at the hospital, just based on some of the material that you've come across?
Well, certainly that would be possible, because the board meeting records actually talk about expenditures and what they were doing and how the buildings that they're building, et cetera, et cetera. One thing that you should be aware of is the fact that this particular hospital was built at the instance of the Freedmen's Bureau. And it was meant to provide care for people. Of course, we may not think that the kind of care that was provided at that time was the best thing, but then everybody was getting that kind of care at that time. And of course, medical thinking has moved on. What's remarkable is that there are late 19th century, early 20th century pictures, photographs, that actually indicate that many of the patients were free to be outside on the grounds. I don't know how often or how frequently, but there certainly are photographs of them doing things, walking around, not only working to raise vegetables, for example, but also having a baseball game. I mean, you know, comes as a surprise, some of that. But then, of course, as the time moves on, and as the hospital tries different treatment modalities, they may become more or less exciting, you know, for anybody to think about. But then, of course, the history of the treatment modalities is of huge interest as well.
What's interesting about that for me is, you know, working for a mental health grant-making foundation, I hear a fair amount about the lack of well-funded alternatives to institutionalization, even today, for those who suffer from serious mental illness. And even though, you know, people's natural tendency is to focus in on the name of the institution, and to kind of heap a bunch of assumptions onto that. I mean, it's probably the case for that for a number of these people at that time, you know, you'd rather have the attention of a mental health professional, however incomplete their understanding might have been, versus, you know, like say the police at that time, you know. Personally, I feel that it's kind of important to keep that, you know, that larger context in mind.
Oh, I think that's definitely true. I mean, one of the things that you see, first of all, is that the belief about mental health in the first place was the racist belief in the South was that Black people didn't actually suffer from mental illness
because they didn't have mentals to, yeah.
So that's why, you know, it comes as a surprise to a lot of people that the Freedmen's Bureau might actually be wanting this to exist, and in fact the community also did, but the reason was that there were real mental illnesses abroad in the land, and they weren't being treated because everybody was saying, oh well, we don't have to do this. So I think that's really interesting. Also, the fact that many of the nursing staff were not white, never were. And so that's very interesting, too, because, you know, one of the things that we're interested in as well is the fact that nursing staff and doctors are also invisible in some of these situations. And it's very interesting to sort of see, okay, what did the nursing staff do? When you look at these admission records, nursing staff are sort of signing people in, and they're making comments. And it's really, you know, they're just saying what their experience tells them, et cetera, et cetera. And they come alive. We don't necessarily know who they were, but we can see them exercising their professional capabilities, which is remarkable.
Okay, so beyond, you know, the implications of this project for, you know, for historians, I can't help but be curious about, you know, what it might mean for, you know, for your field, information studies and digital archiving. And is there any way in which this project could be said to kind of represent, you know, the cutting edge of what it is that, you know, that information professionals like yourself hope to achieve with this kind of thing? And what do you consider to be the greater implications for the field?
Well, one of the things that's very interesting for our field, for digital archiving particularly, but also for archiving in general, is that our younger practitioners are and the field as a whole is starting to be very interested, as it has not been. I mean, if you look at what most archives, people think, oh, this is official, this is government, this is, you know, this is high flown people. But one of the things that is a moving interest in our field is community archives, and we see this basically as a community, the hospital community, and this is its archives, and starting to think of it in that way, that there are many stakeholders who are not official, who are out, you know, who are inside the hospital, either as patients or as practitioners, or who are relatives, or all of these kinds of people who are involved. And our concern is that they get a say in how these materials are handled. I have specialized in the past in thinking about the archives of Native Americans. And there's been a very interesting development, particularly among indigenous people all over the world, to think about the fact that colonialist archives that were created, those indigenous people have been co-creators of those archives. Those archives are about them, and they should have a say in how those archives are managed.
Right.
And that's, again, one of the issues that's very interesting for us as archivists, and it's also very interesting for us in this project.
Right.
Another thing, though, that goes back a little bit further, I don't know if you're familiar with the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission. The Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission was set up as a government agency to thwart the civil rights movement in the late 50s, early 60s. I worked in the state of Mississippi, state archives, for 20 years before I came here. And one of the last things that I worked on was the Sovereignty Commission records and making them available to the public, because they had been litigated open by the ACLU. And what we did, rather than go at them with a magic marker, because they contained a lot of reports of people that were designed to destroy their reputations. In other words, they were dirty tricks, a lot of these materials. And what we were assigned to do by the judge was to make certain that those people who were considered victims in this would have the opportunity to say that their name should not be made public, whereas those people who were so-called state actors, that is, state officials of all kinds, and the people who were employed by this agency, would not be have that power. And so what we had to do, I didn't want, you know, that magic marker to destroy those records, because someday they would be open. And so what we did, I was IT manager for the repository, okay? And so what we did was we worked with a vendor. Nobody had done this before. We worked with a vendor to actually, we ourselves were scanning in all these documents. And as we were scanning them in, we worked with a vendor to design a system so that we would then create an overlay, a virtual overlay, that would have little boxes around each name.
Right.
And then we would have a database that said which pages and where these names were. So that, because we had to go searching these people meantime, and so that we'd have all the names and have the ability to blacken them virtually when somebody said that they wanted their name to be kept private. They had that option. They could say yes or no. Well, finally, you know, we had the list of people. And so the way it would work would be, if that person wanted to see their own stuff, they could. But if anybody else wanted to see it, they would get the image of the record, but that name would be blacked out.
Right. So what it sounds to me is like you're trying to strike this kind of tricky balance between, you know, not just preemptively deciding that, you know, that certain information should be categorically off limits, but at the same time, you know, for those who are, you know, who are real and true stakeholders,
yes,
kind of, you know, affording them some ability to, you know, to say, you know, time out. Are you sure you want to make, you know, this and this available to folks?
Yeah, I mean, that was what was so interesting to me in getting involved in this thing is that I said, oh, I've done this before, or at least part of it. And so it was really interesting, and we've sort of made use of some of the ideas that came out of that project. And in fact, what has happened with that project, the collection was opened in 1997. Ultimately, the decision has been being made to open it further, and we sort of were able, because of the way it was designed, to just sort of carry it forward to new equipment and everything else, and you can actually access those materials online. At first, it was just in the repository that you could do it with a workstation, but you can access those materials online now from the Mississippi Department of Archives and History. So that experience exposed me to a lot of the issues and a lot of the sort of technological problems. One of the things we're trying to do here is that we don't actually have the time. No one has the time to actually go in and transcribe these things because they're all handwritten. And nobody has the time to actually do what we did in Mississippi. We were only talking about, I think, 60,000 sheets of paper as the sum total. But what we're trying to do, and what my colleague Unmil Karadkar is working on, is being able to actually crowdsource the transcription of the documents so that people only see like one letter at a time. And that way we'll actually have text that we can mine using the ability to do things like disambiguate names. And this is a lot more sophisticated computing than we were able to do back then. So there are steps that we'll be able to take now that will also make it possible to sort of achieve the same effect, but at much less cost than we had to do it then.
Okay, so you've mentioned the descendants of the individuals whose records are in the archive. Could you say a little bit more about that and, you know, their presence as stakeholders?
Well, one of the things we know, because the hospital has had an officer who was charged with actually giving families access when it was required, and so they know what the kind of demand has been for people who are simply interested in genealogy. But of course, one of the things that we're beginning to understand about some mental afflictions like schizophrenia is that it may well be something that people can inherit. And so people are concerned to be able to know those things too, to know what the family genealogy is of certain afflictions. And so we know that not only do they want to know who their relatives were, and not only is mental illness less of a stigma now than it was at the time or than it was in the 50s or whatever. But at the same time, people may have concerns for their own health. And that's really a right, I think, that's important to actually serve.
Okay, Dr. Galloway, thanks so much for finding the time to talk to me. And if there are any other big takeaways from this project and why, you know, people who aren't eggheads like you and me should be interested in it, you know, feel free to speak to those.
Well, I think, I mean, just as overall, certainly it's likely that there will be historical research done on these records. And certainly, I mean, I'm not saying there'll be a Ken Burns extravaganza as a result, but certainly I think there will be research that will come out of this and of other things like it that will be very revelatory to people about these kinds of things. One of the things that is interesting also is that one of the things we're charged with as a result of this grant is that we actually attempt to create a system that other states can use. We'll be working with Mississippi, as a matter of fact, because they actually found that their institution for the insane, which burned down a long time ago during World War II, it was nobody in it at the time, by the way, it was already closed. But they have now had to, they have found burials of people who died in that institution that are now on a piece of land that the current University of Mississippi Medical School wants to develop. And so what they have done, the archaeology has been done. I actually have a report on that here, and it shows very nicely laid out graves. And what they want to do is to actually try to do DNA analysis and discover who these people are. Well, they have been digitizing their records as well. And so this is an ideal kind of thing that the states can do where they are, where the state archives come into possession of these materials. And so we're going to be working with other states to look at, okay, so what is your setup and how can our work help you? So that's one big part of what we'll be doing.
Okay, so there's more to come. So, Dr. Galloway, thanks so much for joining us, and just, you know, good luck with everything else.
Thank you.